Well, this is episode 163 with Alexander Lowry. Hi there, my name is Danny Sunshine Bauer, and my mission in life is to help school administrators fight isolation and frustration via a leadership community in order to gain clarity and find solutions to their greatest challenges. I'm also the host of this podcast where each week I share my conversation with top leaders from across the globe to help you accelerate your leadership development. In today's show, I talk with Alexander Lowry, and we explore a number of interesting topics like tempering intensity in order to achieve the vision, the Pareto principle in school leadership. And believe me, this is a really cool part of our talk. You're really going to enjoy that. In Alexander's new program he's built at Gordon College, the Master of Science and Financial Analysis program. What the heck does that have to do with education and this podcast? Well, here's the thing. I love learning from leaders outside of our industry. And I think Alexander's rich experience at Wharton Business School and in the for-profit sector, now leading at Gordon College and building this MBA program, we can learn quite a bit about leadership. As well, I know that there's a number of people that like to pivot within their careers. And so I want you to listen to this episode and think if this Gordon experience is right for you. There's a ton of value within this episode. Thanks for spending some time with me listening to the podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. And before we jump into the episode, I'd like to take some time to thank our show sponsors. A lot of school leaders talk about improving students' soft skills to help them succeed in their rigorous coursework. The problem is that most leaders just talk about it without actually doing anything. You can improve your students' non-cognitive skills today by checking out an amazing program called Organized Binder. Learn more at organizedbinder.com. Students who participate in the Conrad Challenge don't learn to think outside the box. There is no box. Learn how innovation takes off and soars beyond the confines of a box at conradchallenge.org.
Hey everyone, this is Stacey Lindis from Podcast PD, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual host. Make sure you check out all of the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com and get ready because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Well, hey there, better leaders. Today, I'm joined by Alexander Lowry. And Alexander's a professor of finance, as well as an advisor and board of directors member for fintech and financial service companies, which means he is transforming, accelerating, and advising businesses that students he's educating want to work for. As a professor, Alexander helps students understand how the financial services industry works. He also leads a master's in financial analysis program, helping students bridge their liberal arts background to a focused career in finance. As a board member, Alexander works with fintech and financial service companies that want to transform traditional industry business models to unleash exponential growth and value. He brings expertise in governance, strategy, growth, financial management, and operations. As a CEO advisor, Alexander mentors CEOs and boards who want to turn strategy into action. He's currently working with 20 plus early stage and middle market businesses. Welcome to the show, Alexander.
Danny, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
So I'd like to start with, you know, what constitutes a perfect day at work for you?
What I love is every day is different. I'm not the guy who'd be great working in a factory producing the same widget in the same way every day. So we have this doesn't roll off the tongue, but it's the Master of Science in Financial Analysis is the full name of the program, which I abbreviate down to say Masters in Finance. These are the people to wrap their head around. And this is a new program. We have our first class coming in January. We'll have our second class coming in August. We start the autumn semester. So I'm still in startup mode for that, which is very exciting. And you have that underneath the larger Gordon College brand and resources. So it's sort of the best of both worlds as you're off and running, building something brand new while building it into an established place. And the nice thing for me every day is that I'm working on different things. So the way I described it is if the tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, maybe the tree doesn't exist. We could build the greatest program in the world, but if we don't raise awareness of it, we don't have the students, we don't have the job opportunities for them to go to, it doesn't exist. So every day I'm working on three things, really, setting up the program. And after a couple of years, this will just be turning of a handle. and this will happen again and again regularly. So imagine setting up the classes, working with the faculty, doing all the administrative process work. And then the second thing is finding the students. And the third thing is finding the job opportunities, both for internships and full-time employment when they graduate.
And who is your ideal, I guess, student you're attracting to this new program?
Great question. We have two programs. We have both a part-time and a full-time. Part-time is very easy to imagine. It's probably someone who lives in the greater Boston area who probably already has a good job they don't want to leave, perhaps a family, perhaps a home, and they can come one night a week and it fits into their busy schedule. And then for the full-time, we have sort of two different targets. There's the people coming direct from undergrad who are looking to burnish their credentials, and there are people who will come 2 to 7 years out and will do this one-year master's in finance, which is focused, faster, more affordable alternative to an MBA. And for the direct from undergrad, there are probably three buckets of people, right? So imagine math or physics majors who realize, hey, I don't want to get a PhD and I don't want to teach, but Wall Street loves quants. So if you give them a year of learning all of the language and the precise information you need to get a finance job, they're going to easily be hired. There were people like me who might have been a history major or a poli-sci major who have quant ability, but just studied what they were passionate about, but realized, hey, I need to get a good job now and pay off my student debt. The same way if you put them through a finishing program for a year, the way I think about it is a liberal arts student has a learning curve and they have to catch up with, say, the Wharton undergrads who studied for finance for 4 years. Once they get that knowledge and they catch up, a liberal arts student excels beyond because they learn the skills of researching, writing, communicating, presenting, the stuff that a student focused on the BBA didn't pick up. And then there are people who were studying finance, business, or accounting undergrad, and maybe they went to a school in the middle of nowhere, and therefore the big employers wouldn't come because you can't hire enough people to make worthwhile a trip. And since we're outside Boston, now you have access to all of those companies, and you've got a differentiated resume because you've got a master's degree versus the students who are applying just with a bachelor's. So that's a quick overview of our target market.
Yeah, and something that I read in your career summary that you sent over that I find interesting is this idea of transforming, right, the traditional model. And part of this podcast is really to connect with as many educators as possible and then as many people outside of the industry as possible too. Just try to learn innovative ideas, best practices, things that are working so that we can look at maybe inefficient or ineffective aspects of what we currently do within education and transform it. And so I'm curious if you have, you know, maybe you've boiled this down, maybe you haven't, but is there a framework or an approach, right? When you are looking at this tradition and you're trying to innovate within that space, like how do you approach that work?
Maybe a great way to answer that, we can talk about why and how this program came about, because it was about innovation. It was about solving a market need. Mm-hmm. And it was really this Gordon College as an institution stepping back, looking at the Great Recession 10 years ago and saying, what would be the right response to this? And I think a room full of rational people would all nod their heads and agree that we could use more ethical decision-making in financial services. And that would have solved a lot of the problems that we got ourselves into. So I was at JP Morgan before this, and we had the famous London Whale scandal, and it was a massive issue. Jamie Dimon, the well-known CEO, when we was first asked about it, when it first came up, he said, this is a tempest in a teapot. It's not a big deal. It was a really big deal. It was representative of the fact that JP Morgan, they talk about it as too big to fail. It's almost too big to manage, right? You're talking about four Fortune 500 companies within one, and management did not fully understand all the details happening on the ground because it's such a big business. And one of our responses to that is, okay, I know business schools are coming from the top down saying, how do we help leaders solve the problem? We were coming at it from the bottom up and saying, how do you produce more people that are going to go out into the financial service industry and focus not just on themselves doing well, but doing well while doing good? And so our view is, take the typical MBA. I'll give you my Wharton MBA experience. Every business school has one ethics class. Your first year, you do a little bit of knowledge on everything, strategy, operations, accounting, marketing, finance, and you'll have one ethics class. My Wharton ethics class, the professor had been teaching it for 40 years. Yeah. And he walked in on the first class, and you've got 80 or 90 students chatting away in the room, and he throws this huge manila folder down the table in the middle. So all the students stop, they turn and they look, points at this big folder, massive folder, and he says, these are all of my students over the last 40 years who've gone to jail. And we looked at that and we said, wow, I'd like to have an equivalent where you slide a little folder across the table in our ethics class and it's empty. And you say, our goal is to never put anybody in here. Now, obviously, Wharton is one factor. It's the biggest business school. They produce a huge amount of graduates. They've got about 100,000 alumni, right? And they also have the elite type who are pushing the envelope. So I get that some of the people are going to get in trouble. But a very different philosophy for us, where ethics is not one class. It's embedded across all of our classes.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because the problem is, like, what I'm hearing is that it was siloed off, right? And it was only available in this one area. It was talked about briefly, and it didn't integrate within all the coursework that students were engaged with. Is that correct?
Yeah, you can think of it as a bolt-on, and it was a check the box saying, yes, we've taught them that. Whereas for us, that is part of the core of our approach and how we're going about it.
Right. It makes me think of, too, you know, sitting in within a school district, they'll have you watch these type of ethics videos. And that's because they can't think of a creative way to integrate it within the actual job role. And so this is, you know, hours of content with the most boring and ridiculous stories ever that you could pretty much just ignore the video, you know, come back 15 minutes after it's played, take an educated guess at the questions, and probably still score 95% or higher. So I really appreciate that integrated approach you're taking. So I'm curious too, based on your experience, what you bring to Gordon and the diverse experience you've had prior to this, you know, what leadership lessons you've really learned that are top of mind and that you think would benefit the listeners today?
So one of the things that we talk about in our program, and I'll answer it in sort of a roundabout way, is think about the faculty that we're going to bring to our master's in finance program. I want a combination of theorists and practitioners, the people who have both been in academia forever, are steeped in that knowledge, understand those ways, but also people that have been working out in the real world. Imagine the experiences and the discussions are very different between those groups. And in some ways, that mirrors my lessons and background bringing. So Wharton clearly wanted someone to help with the brand, who would understand the market, could make the connection. So the fact that I have an MBA from Wharton, the fact that I worked at a place like JP Morgan for 4.5 years, who actually understands financial services and can help the school make that bridge. Certainly they want someone with those credentials leading it, but also someone who brings that thought process behind it. So the business world, of course, is very different than the nonprofit educational environment. And I'm trying to marry between the two of those. I'm sure some of my colleagues would say I'm a bit intense at times and a bit of the for-profit world environment, got to do things very quickly. But yeah, bringing those different perspectives together, I think, adds a lot of values. And to me, I was talking with one of my friends on Friday, who runs a child development center up here for people that have disabilities. And he talked about, he is the background of the PhD and understands the students and how to make the environment work, versus the situation where he's got a professional business manager who gets business and runs it and is about saving money. And my friend Ryan is like, I don't really care about the saving money. I'm about engaging with the students, but you need that person to help the business run successfully and be profitable. And I think that's a parallel with what you're talking about. You need to bring all of those different perspectives into each school's environment, and that's how you make it a holistic success.
You know, you talked about your intensity there. Is there a need to temper that, or I'm trying to think and translate, you know, for the listener, how do you bring the passion, right, to your work, yet still keep people engaged, keep people connected, you know, to you? Because listen, you're casting the vision, but without the people, the vision isn't going to materialize. So I'm curious, yeah, how you process that.
Absolutely. And I think there's a two-part answer to that. Partly, that's why you have a team of people and you've got really good, smart, and helpful people around you, and people have different skill sets, right? No, either someone is an all-rounder, which means they're, you know, average to good in everything, versus people who are specialists who are great in different areas, and together they can solve it. And part of that is the stakeholder management, the communications, the teamwork. Some people are very good at engaging with other human beings. Other people are really good at perhaps being in a locker room and coding, right? So we all have different skills and recognizing that. But then there's also on the individual level, understanding where your strengths and weaknesses are. And for some people, they are process oriented and they are just focused on putting their head down and getting things done. And for them, they need help reminding, well, come above the parapet, put your head back up there, engage with the people around you, because you've got to get buy-in to your ideas, like you're talking about. They have to make it be successful for them, and you have to do it in a certain way. So part of it for me is just learning the educational model, and the timeline is very different. So for example, students at a college would have a 4-year lifespan, but the school environment, actually for higher education, they tend to do 7 years. Think about all the committee work and how they move and progress. So there's very different ways of doing things. We have to make sure we do them together.
And thinking about temper and intensity, also things that energize you and help you bring your best to show up your best at work. Do you have any types of routines or rituals that help you have an impactful day?
Well, for me, I'm trying to keep that work-life balance. And that was also a big part of us moving into academia, was trying to find ways to engage on the home life in a different way and be thoughtful about all of that. So how do you balance not doing 100 hours a week as you did back at JP Morgan, and instead be in an environment where you get to come home and see your family and see my new infant daughter and engage and get the right sleep and get the working out as well, which I find to be very helpful. I know when I'm exercising, I'm a more focused and more effective employee. So I tend to feel like that there are five big buckets in life. You got your family, your faith, your fitness, your finances, and your friends, and job falls into the finances for me. And I think you can do three of those five well at any given time. If you try to do all five, you're going to be average in them at best. You have to make sacrifices in life. And it's maybe you're sacrificing your social life, your friends, and for a certain period of time. And maybe you're saying, well, I'm not going to be able to work out as much as I used to. I'll do a couple days instead of every day. I think you have to literally prioritize your life in order to figure out what you want to do well in.
Yeah. And back to your program, you know, where do you think it might be in 5-6 years?
We envision growing to a large size for our program, but to be very specific to ours. So the biggest business schools are Wharton and Harvard. You're talking 800, 900 people a class. We don't ever want to be anything like that. We envision being a very small, focused environment where people have the chance to make deep network and connections among themselves. So we envision, I think the top end are probably about 30 people in our full-time class and 20 people in our part-time class. So there aren't too many that you can't get to know them on a deep personal level, but also we want our students and our faculty to be very engaged. I remember being at Wharton and feeling like this is a factory and they churn the handle every year. And while they know my name, I'm just going to be replaced by the next widget next year.
Yeah. And so you're trying to create, I guess, a more personalized and I don't want to say comfortable. I think that's the wrong word, but almost familiar or safe environment that you feel really plugged into, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's wild. And from a leadership standpoint, what do you do when you're working with your team to actually create that environment that attracts, you know, the right type of person, repels the others, and gives them that personalized type experience?
Well, for us, it's about understanding ourselves as a team and what we want to accomplish, just like you talked about. How do we know what the goal is we want to achieve? And you know, imagine for your listeners, a principal at a school is going to be setting a clear environment of what do we want to be focused on and how do we make it work? And there's probably short-term goals of this year versus 5 years out, what we want to achieve with those. And for us, it's the same way. What do we want our program to look like? And success for us is, you know, 5 years down the line that our people are getting placed into good jobs, but getting promoted and mentoring others and passing on that same knowledge. Because if we can make an exponential difference by them educating their colleagues around them, that makes a difference. So how do you find the people that are going to do that? I think there's only two things we have to look for. So imagine the equivalent of you're hiring for a job as well, in the same way you're finding the students. I want passion and intelligence. Those are the two things I cannot train. I can train everything else. Mm-hmm. So if someone is really smart and really driven to be successful in this and very excited about it, you give them the right knowledge, I think they'll be off and running and we'll do a wonderful job.
Are there any tools or activities or tasks you have people actually complete? Like, how do you measure passion and intelligence?
Great question. So imagine in the for-profit world, the environment people go through, they put them through different types of interviews, from individual one-on-one to groups to taking a battery of tests to doing a written statement. In the same way you do that in the educational environment, and you're trying to help the students by looking at what are their standardized test scores, reading their essays, doing a personal interview with them, having to chat with different people to getting feedback. And you do the best you can. There's no perfect system to it. If someone had figured out the right mousetrap, it would be so much easier. But at the end of the day, also think about it, it's a two-way process. I'm trying to get the right sense for the student. I also want them to get the right sense of the program to make sure that this is the right fit for them, because we feel like our school is unique and doing things differently. And we only want people that are bought into that approach.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And when you're talking about these goals and the type of student you're trying to attract and that kind of thing within your team, what does it look like to communicate the goals so that they take root, right? The seeds are implanted within your team members' minds. And so is that consistent, you know, review during meetings? I don't want to, you know, lead you on too much, but I'm just curious how you review those goals so that they're real, right? And they're top of mind for everybody.
I think communication is key, and I'm a big believer that you can't over-communicate. It's possible, and I'd much rather have someone tell me, hey, I've heard this message 15 times. I get it. You can stop. But I think tends to be for most people, we hear messages through our own filter. We often filter things out because it's a busy, noisy world. So how do we take advantage of these different opportunities, like you talked about, for different team meetings? This is a good example for me. How do we share our messages in different formats? Imagine a lot of the young people today when they're looking at schools. I don't want to use the word lazy, but these are what some people know. They're interested. They don't want to read. They just want to watch videos, right? And that's fine. It doesn't matter. How do you get to people in a way that communicates to them in the way that they'd like to hear? So for me, it's using different channels and different styles of communication. I'm a big believer in the VACOG model of communication. There's the five senses: your visual, auditory, kinesthetic, olfactory, and gustatory. There's majority of people tend to be visual or audio, but there are the five different senses. How do you talk in the different languages? Because that way you make sure you get to people in the way that they think and react. So I need to communicate not the way I want to hear, but the way my audience wants to hear.
Yeah, that's so important. You know, and just definitely want to highlight that for the listeners, because a lot of times we default to what's most comfortable for us and the way we like to receive information ourselves. But that could be completely incongruent with the people that are in front of us, right? The people that need to hear the message that you're sharing. And if you don't, take just a little bit of time to consider where they're coming from and create a message crafted specifically for them. Like, what's the point going all the way back to the beginning of the interview? You know, if the tree falls in the forest but nobody hears it, did it really fall? Same thing with your program, right? If you share a message too as a leader and it's not hidden with your people, but you didn't design it for them, then what was the point?
And I tend to take that a couple different ways. You can think about Myers-Briggs or even take it to your personal life with the five love languages. What I love about those is you learn about yourself, but also the person you're doing it with. Imagine doing love languages with your spouse, or if you're taking your team and everybody does Myers-Briggs, it gives you a framework to realize how you take the information, what you value. But the key for me is really the other part of that is learning about the people that I care about, who I am engaged with. How did they learn? How do they like to learn? How do they like to receive? How does my wife appreciate things? She clearly doesn't appreciate them the exact same way I do it. So if I do things my way, it doesn't really resonate with her. In the same way with your team, you can also translate to your audience. You're not going to know their Myers-Briggs type, but the more you get to know someone, perhaps during the interview, you can begin to imagine, oh, they are such and such. So let me say this in a different way that'll resonate with them.
Love it. And I think this is a good place before we end the interview. Let's pause right here for a message from our sponsors. Today's show is proudly sponsored by Organized Binder, a program which gives students daily exposure to goal setting, reflective learning, time and task management, study strategies, organization skills, and more. Organized Binder's color-coded system is implemented by the teacher through parallel process with students, helping them create a predictable and dependable classroom routine. You can learn more and improve your students' executive functioning and non-cognitive skills at organizedbinder.com. All right, and we're back with Alexander Lowry. And Alexander, I'd like to ask this question quite a bit. Tony Robbins is famous for saying quality questions create a quality life. Successful people ask better questions, and as a result, they get better answers. What do you think is one question that school leaders need to be asking themselves right now?
For me, it's everyone has the same sort of approach 80% of the time. And the difference between good and great is sometimes that little difference of 80 to 20%. I'm a big believer in a Pareto principle. It's very easy to get to 80% very quickly. And you have to figure out where the few places you need perfection, because that's a lot of time. So getting from the 80% towards the 100%. And so I would say for every school leader, you think about your time, your goals, how you spend your day, your effort, your small budgets, whatever it might be, is where is good good enough and where do I need perfection? I can get to 80% either myself or giving it to someone else, delegating it down to that very quickly. And good is good enough in most areas. And let's move on and get on to the next priority. Where do I need the higher level? Where do I need to focus the time and the energy to actually achieve the results? So Pareto principle would tell you 80% of your revenue is going to come from 20% of your customers, or 20% of your tasks take 80% of your time. So for me, it's just being really thoughtful and stepping back and evaluating every chance I get. Does this add value in whatever way I'm thinking about? Is good good enough, or do I need to do better on that?
Yeah, I like that a lot. I'm familiar with the Pareto principle, but I really appreciate that question, Alexander. Where is good enough, and where do I need perfection? Because a lot of times, you know, we'll get stuck, right? Because of analysis paralysis or perfection, and a lot of times we don't ask for help or delegate because we think, well, I could do it better. Why give it to somebody else? And it doesn't free you up to do what you're truly special at. So that, I really love that. Where's good enough, and where do I need perfection? I'm wondering if you could think of a recent example you might have actually applied this question, this strategy within the work that you do.
Sure. So our website's a good example. So I have been working with our marketing experts to try and figure out, how do we change it? What are the results? What do we need to do? I, of course, have a very high standard. I want everything to be achieved, but time is limited. Budget is limited. So what we did is we sat down with our Google Analytics recently, and we're looking at the website. Where are people coming? Where are they stopping? How much time are they spending on it? And we realized at the moment on our website, what's going to make the most difference is the tuition and aid page. So that's where I'm going to focus my efforts at the moment on improving. There's so much I want to do in the website, but we need to do it in a way that's going to have the most bang for the buck. So that helped us step back and realize, well, we need to get perfection on this page.
I love that too, because you're incorporating data, right? And again, back to speaking, but how people receive the message that you're sending, you're looking at folks' behavior. And when they visit your website, where are they hanging out the most? And let me make that place the best experience possible. If I'm hearing you right, I think that's what you're sharing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want them to tell me what I need to be focused on. I don't have to guess and make it up myself.
Concerning education, what do you think is one class that we need to add to our schools that's not currently taught that you know of?
So ethics and leadership was something that we talked about at the beginning. And leadership is this buzzword. Everybody loves to talk about it. You're going to graduate and get a job and you'll be a leader. Think about the millennial generation. One of the things that they get so frustrated about is they get into a job that my generation or the great generation would have just taken, put their head down, and imagine our grandparents would have worked at IBM for 40 years and got a gold watch, and you slowly worked your way up the hierarchy. The millennials have this sense that I've been told I can be a leader and I can change the world. And they get frustrated on day two when they're not the CEO of the company and they're just working on a widget or a spreadsheet. So we need to do a better job of helping people not only understand their expectations, and I don't want to take anything away because that's a great idea for the world to want to be changed by each generation. But part of that begins with learning about ethics and leadership. You can lead from behind. You don't have to be at the front to lead. So everybody is a leader in the sense of, imagine we came back to some of the ethical issues that happened in the financial services industry. You can be a leader in the middle of one of those semi-crises by saying, ooh, I see where this is going to go. We shouldn't be doing this. This is a bad idea. So leadership is both the micro and the macro level to me. So we're all leading every single day in my home environment with my wife, with my child, with my colleagues. You are making decisions that impact other people and will have a ripple effect beyond that immediate moment.
What's one book, video, tool, or resource, Alexander, that has really impacted your leadership, productivity, or quality of life this year?
So I think it goes back to what I talked about before, those five buckets and reassessing them and where do I want to spend my most time. And for us, a big part of also this job was the quality of life. So how do I balance what I'm doing in the office to make sure I have time at home for the other stuff that I want to do? So the study that everybody talks about was, who are the most famous people and the most successful people in the world? People say, oh, it must be Harvard students. Okay, so the Harvard graduates amongst themselves are the best of the best. And who elevates above them? And they realize, well, there are people who set goals versus people who are just graduating. Okay, and in the people who told other people those goals were even better than people who just set goals. So the way that I tend to think about it is, imagine it's January 1st is when a lot of people tend to do this. I'm going to have goals for the year. And maybe it's between those five buckets, you have a goal for each one of those. And then you're going to pick out the three that are the most important. And these are where you're really going to focus. I'm going to write them down. I'm actually going to share them with a couple people on my, I have a personal board, and I think everyone should, to help hold me accountable and coach me through it and give me ideas to make them successful. And that's how I think you produce better results.
Can you stay at the personal board real quick and share maybe how did you set it up? How did you find the people? How often do you meet and what kind of things they might speak into your life?
Sure. And imagine it less formal than a real board, sort of like the boards that I'm on. This is a personal board you set up, and I think everyone should. I tend to think you want to consider it three levels, up, down, and sideways. So upwards is where I have my personal board. I have people that, you know, are downward to me and give me their time and their expertise that are more senior to me. I have people on my level, my peers, Well, we're getting ideas from each other and learning about our environments. And then I've got people downward where I'm on the board for them and I'm coaching and guiding them. So I have people that I've met over my walks of life, and my board will change over time in life, whether it's the time commitment that I need or what the other person can give or the expertise that they have to bring. In much the same way a board of a professional company, you want people with different experts and insights. Imagine that you're a principal of a school. Some of your board people might be superintendents, people who are retired principals who can coach you on that. In the same way, it could be you want a couple people from your personal life, whether you're trying to be better at your fitness or better at your family, people that can speak into those areas. So for me, we don't have necessarily formal board meetings, but I call it my personal board, my mentors, my advisors that I can reach out to and check in with and get feedback from, and who will actually will follow up with me if I've gone radio silent for a while because I've been busy. Yep. So I think it's a useful thing for everybody to have.
For sure. And Alexander, before our last question, was there anything about your program that I didn't ask you about that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I appreciate that opportunity. For me, we think about this, the Masters in Finance program, the way that I describe it, it's a better, faster, more affordable alternative to an MBA. I think an MBA is absolutely the right approach for a lot of people. But an MBA is the default at this point. Everybody feels like they have to have one, and you want those three letters. And you can argue if you go to one of the top 10 schools, it definitely pays for itself, right? So Wharton, MBA, the top schools like that are getting closer to 200. It's a huge amount of debt to take on. And our view is people should step back in the same way we would think about for your own educational institutions that you're probably coaching. Take a step back. What do you need to achieve? What do people actually need out of it? Think about college now. Some people will go 2 years to a community college and then transfer to a big school to cut the debt load in half. So what are the clever ways that people can do it differently? And we think about our program, you get the same technical knowledge as the second year of your MBA. It's just focus in finance if that's what you want to do. And then you're back out earning in your environment in half the time for 1 year instead of 2 years. So we're excited about what it's going to accomplish and just looking to raise awareness with the right students.
All right. Well, Alexander, you made it to the end of the podcast. You've been a wonderful guest. I'm really excited that we've connected, and I think you brought a ton of value for the listeners of the show. And this is an interesting question because you've actually done this with your program. But I ask every single guest that you're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by any resources. Your only limitation is your imagination. How would you build your dream school? What would be your top three priorities? And I know you were probably limited, obviously, by some resources and that sort of thing. But you did build this program from the ground up. So I'm just curious how you'd approach that question.
Well, if you take off the resource constraints, I think what's really exciting is you can start by setting some goals and being clear what you want to achieve. For example, we talked about the ethical grounding. That's a big part of ours. I think the first thing people want to do is figure out exactly what do you want your reputation, if you want to think about it as your legacy to be. So we envision 5-10 years from now, our employees are out there in leadership roles, they're coaching and mentoring other people who didn't go to our program, taking that ethical perspective we're saying and inculcating across financial services. I think for everybody else, the first step is, what are your specific goals? I talked about my friend who runs a school for people with disabilities, right? He is helping people who have less opportunities out there to get on that track. So it's, what is your unique niche? And once you've figured that out, what are the resources that you want to put behind it? Do you want to bring in, if you're a Harvard or Wharton, the rock star professors that attract the students? Or are you more interested in the types of teachers who are actually going to be the best people to engage with the students, who are going to make the best experience out of it? And then how do you compensate them accordingly to make it work, incentivize and motivate? And to me, that's a big difference between the for-profit world and education. You don't necessarily have those same resources behind it. But if we've taken away the constraints, you can now go out there and find all the right people. So at the end of the day, people are human beings, and the students are going to have such a difference from the teachers in the room. So I tend to think about it as a college class, the way I describe it to people coming to our program. Imagine you have the best class at your college. You're so excited you got a spot in it, but the regular professor is sick and someone new stands in and they're terrible. Now the best class has become a terrible class. In the same way, the worst class at your school, you got assigned to it, you're not excited about it. The regular teacher got sick and they have a stand-in, and this person is amazing, the best teacher in the history of the world. Now the worst class has become the best class. At the end of the day, the people you have working for you and working with you make all the difference.
Well, Alexander, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Any parting words of advice, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Well, Danny, I appreciate that. So for us, the easiest way to get in touch with two ways would be the website. So gordon.edu/gradfinance, or my wife would tell you that my email is probably always attached to my hand. I usually have my phone in it. So the Master of Science in Financial Analysis, MSFA. So MSFA@gordon.edu is the email that comes straight to me. And in terms of our parting thought, I would say that I'd love that all of your listeners are working on trying to become better themselves and improving their educational environment, and just keep going, keep working hard, because we need those people in the schools trying to do that for our students and our future.
Better leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember, life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Danny and Alexander. Head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Alexander in the search bar. The show notes page will pop up. You'll get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Alexander, thank you so much for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
It was a pleasure, Danny. Thank you for having me.
All right, better leaders, just a few more things before you take off. I created a new resource for you called The 3 Leadership Questions I Ask Every Day. You can download the resource by visiting betterleadersbetterschools.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. This helps me in a few ways. It gives the show some social proof, it encourages new people to listen to the show, and it improves the ranking of the show and therefore helps me serve more school leaders. If you want extra credit and some good vibes, share your biggest takeaway from the show and tag me on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is Alien Earbud, an anagram for my name, Daniel Bauer, and make sure to use the hashtag BLBS. This Sunday is the weekend resource. Join over 3,000 school leaders that get this resource delivered every week. In the weekend resource, I share content curated specifically for school leaders. You'll get articles, videos, templates, and exercises, coaching tips, inspirational quotes, invitations to free Friday group coaching, which is an exclusive offer made available only to newsletter subscribers in the Better Leaders, Better Schools tribe, and links to all the content I created for you this past week. You can subscribe at betterleadersbetterschools.com/weekend-resource. And remember, life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader.